Hello, why Pink Floyd have become just another plaque on the wall. Playwright Debbie Tucker Green breaks her no interviews rule to discuss her debut feature film. In his first interview, new Arts Council boss Darren Henley warns against further cuts, and artist Michael Craig Martin gives the Royal Academy walls a multicoloured makeover.
Often when colour is used in galleries or museums, people use bland colours, greys and dark greens and beiges and things like that. This kills works of art.
More later from Michael Craig Martin at the Royal Academy Summer Show. But we start with new meaning for the term heritage rock.
A very short stroll from the front row studio out onto Regent Street, and I'm at the entrance to the University of Westminster, once known as the Regent Street Polytechnic. It was here in the early 1960s that three young architecture students turned their attentions from designing buildings to making music. And after a few lineup changes and several names, they settled on Pink Floyd. Now there's a commemorative plaque being unveiled to mark a moment of musical heritage.
Well, we were here all those years ago. I think I was here longer than anybody else because they kept throwing me out and I kept having to go and do proper jobs. No. I don't know what else to say, really, except this is obviously an extraordinary honour to have this thing erected here. And I'm now going to let Nick, and he, I believe, is the only one who came out of the experience as a qualified drummer. So over to you, Nick.
I think we're delighted, honoured and everything else to have this plaque. And thank you all very much for turning up.
The strings behind you.
The strings behind me.
Well, there we are, the plaque is unveiled. Interestingly, not a blue plaque, but a black one. It reads, Pink Floyd, between 1962 and 1966. Nick Mason, Roger Waters and Richard Wright studied at the Regent Street Polytechnic, where they formed the band. Richard Wright, the keyboardist, died in 2008. But I'm going to head inside now with Nick Mason and Roger Waters and ask them about their memories of this place.
Where we actually met is Little Titchfield Street, which is around the corner.
Just across the road, really.
Yeah, and that's now been demolished, in fact. So this is close to, rather than actual. And
but you used to come to this building for lectures as architecture students?
No. I don't think we did. No.
Not at all?
No,
so
not at
your
all.
Your campus, your building, yeah, is a couple of streets away.
And it no longer exists.
And it no longer exists.
Yes, exactly. Who's that bloke? Was he called Mr. Wickham? We used to have to do drawings in the street.
It's slightly scary. It's
like, I remember towards the end of the first or second term, I finally turned up for one. And he was brilliant. He looked at me and he went, who? And I said, Waters. And I'm looking down the list and he went, you don't exist, Waters. Next.
You started off playing together as the T-set, didn't you? Was that the first name?
We can't remember the order of events. We were the Architectural Abdabs, the Megadeths, the T-set.
Earlier. Sigma-6.
Sigma-6, yeah.
They were all before the T-set.
Yes, because the T-set was the one before Pink Floyd, because that's how the band got its name.
Because you were in the T-room?
No.
Ah.
Don't... I'll do the story. We were playing somewhere, I think it was somewhere like Northolt, and the promoter came down and said, OK, boys, you're on next. What's the name of the band? I'll introduce you. And we said, we're the T-Set. And he went, you can't be, they're on now. And there was another band called the T-Set. So we needed an instant change. And I think it was Sid who was carrying around a couple of the old blues albums, and it had a couple of players on it, Pink Anderson and Floyd Council. And he looked at it and he went, Pink Floyd.
Portmanteau name.
A bloody good story, isn't
it? It's a brilliant story.
Yeah. You just made that up, didn't you?
So you met here, you became friends here. Were there any gigs here at this Polytechnic?
Yeah, we did. We rehearsed here. And we were the sort of, I suppose you could call us the house band, so there was a captive audience, really.
We opened, didn't we, for the Tridents, which was Jeff Beck's first band.
Right, yeah. And for the Beat Merchants, I believe.
Oh, the beat version. Arnold Lane had a strange hobby, collecting clothes, moonshine, washing lines.
I've noticed that Joe Boyd, the legendary producer, is here today as well. He produced your very first single, Arnold Lane. Would that have been a part of the set when you were playing here in Regent Street?
Probably not. Well, because when we were here, this was pre-Syd Barrett. So it would have been a bit of a long shot. No, I was just trying to remember if this building was the venue for the Student Hops, in which case... Oh, okay.
It had a proscenium, the small hall. It had a sloping floor and it had a proscenium. And this is where we put the plays on as well.
I was an actor.
All right. He wasn't very good.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah. Even though you've never been in this building before.
Never.
Roger Waters and Nick Mason of Pink Floyd at the Regent Street Polytechnic this morning. With acclaimed plays including Stoning Mary, Generations, and in particular Random, a heartbreaking monologue about knife crime, Debbie Tucker-Green gives voice to urgent, raw and often angry issues on stage, but she always lets the drama do the talking and refuses to give interviews. Well, now with the release of her first feature film, Second Coming, which she wrote and directed, she's decided to face the front row microphone. The film stars Nadine Marshall as Jax, a wife and mother, who struggles to explain to her husband Mark, played by Idris Elba, how she's become pregnant with her second child. The couple haven't had sex for a long time and she hasn't slept with anybody else.
Eat your food. This one. You, big enough to know better.
I'm eating it.
Eating, don't mean playing. Have I got your school bag?
Yeah.
Mark, I don't got time.
JJ, eat breakfast. What?
Later.
All right, then.
Idris Elba, Nadine Marshall and newcomer Kai Francis Lewis as their son Jerome in Second Coming. When writer and director Debbie Tucker-Green came to Front Row to discuss the film, along with Nadine, I asked whether, as the writer, she knew what had caused the apparently immaculate conception.
Yeah, I have my thoughts. I'm sure you have your thoughts, Miss Nadine. And audiences have had their thoughts as well. So that's been kind of interesting, just seeing people having discussions and arguments about what they think happened.
Well, let's ask Nadine Marshall for her thoughts, because you're playing Jax, this woman who actually is repressing so much, and this is, you're having to, as an actress, having to express a sense of repression and internalised trauma to an extent. I mean, how did you come to understand that character?
It was a long process. It took me a while to get into Jack's head. I couldn't understand why she didn't just tell him. Why didn't she? Because it would have just made things much easier. It'd been a short piece, but just tell him. But I just had to give myself over to the fact that maybe this thing that happened to her is, I don't know, non-explanatory and she just has to deal with it. I didn't want to go in with any kind of preconceived ideas. And I wanted to make the journey with Jax. So as Jax is discovering and the story's unfolding, it shows that it's discovering with me as well.
And Debbie, does the dialogue just flow? Do you sit down at the page and just hear the voices and then just translate that to the page? Or is it structurally sketched out before you start?
I find it hard to explain because I don't quite understand it myself, but it's not like a structured kind of boom, boom, A, B, C, D. Normally my stuff starts with dialogue and I don't always know where it's going to go. And this was the same. Some of the different plays and different work has come out in different ways, but yeah, I find it very hard to explain, but it's not clinical.
Is that difficult for you, Nadine, working with Debbie when she finds it hard?
By the time she gets it, it's on point.
It's worked through by then.
It's finished, but it's like a piece of canvas, really, and then I just put my own painting on top of it, but that's the setting is there for me.
I mean, there's so many actors who talk about working with playwrights and having that relationship and knowing where they come from and what the ideas are that lie behind the work. There's always those stories of actors working with Harold Pinter and asking him what the play's about, and he says, "I don't know. You know, what's the motive for my character? How should I know?" So it's a bit like that.
But the difference is, I have a history with Debbie. I know Debbie personally, so that makes it easier. When a piece of her script comes my way, I kind of know what's going on slightly in her mind, mostly.
Well, you have a very strong working relationship, and Debbie, you've worked on well, a recurring working relationship then. I mean, I saw Nadine on stage at the Royal Court Theatre a few years ago in Random, which is an incredibly powerful piece. Debbie, are you writing primarily for Nadine? Do you have Nadine in mind when you set out a character?
No, and, you know, it's not a given. I don't know how it looks from the outside in. You know, Nads comes in and generally auditions for stuff as with anybody else. So it's not a given.
Oh, so you're still going to work for the part, Nadine?
Oh, yeah.
To an extent, Debbie, you were asking the audience to do a lot of work as well, because in your pieces, very often, the situation that you are addressing emerges very slowly and subtly. It's not laid out. We saw it in Random, we've seen it in other works that you've done for the stage, but with Second Coming, it's not immediately apparent what the situation is. We have to do a lot of work just piecing together some of the dialogue. And that's a stylistic device. You've always done that.
It's not a really self-conscious kind of withholding of stuff. It kind of comes out how it comes out. So it's not trying to be cute. It literally is. This is how the story has evolved through writing it. And, you know, audiences are not to be underestimated as well, you know, regardless of whether it's very explicit or whether it's slightly more ambiguous. I can't control how people want to respond to it. So it's not a self-conscious kind of, oh, let's hold back from this and that. It literally, this is how the piece is.
Right. I mean, you're suggesting that your plays are not to you, the situations, the characters, the things, the issues that you're addressing are not oblique to you. I'm suggesting they probably are to many viewers. But your whole approach to writing, the way that you explain your art and your craft, you are quite oblique, aren't you? I mean, you very rarely give interviews. Why is that?
Can't you tell?
Is it shyness?
I think it's some of that, but also, you know, the work is there to kind of speak for itself. You know, it doesn't need me. If you want to go, it's cool. If you don't want to go, I can't argue with that. And then if, you know, what people make of it, want to discuss, that's up to them. Not horrible, you know, which is cool. So it's doesn't matter what I say.
Nadine, let me talk about the filming of Second Coming, because there is a very taut and sort of quite claustrophobic feeling within this family home. Because Jax is having to keep a lid on all of these feelings. She has a secret. Mark, her husband, is trying to reach out to her. We're not sure about their relationship at first. Was a lot of that improvised with Idris Elba as Mark?
No, when it came to filming, we were working purely off the script, but we did have a couple of days rehearsal beforehand to muck about with it and improvise and all that kind of stuff and kind of get me and Idris and Kai together just to see if we could gel as a family without the script. So that's what we did a couple of days before going in.
Yeah, because I mean, we absolutely believe that this is a family. And you say you spent a couple of days together with Idris and Kai, who is the young actor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an astonishing performance as young Jerome as well. But what did you do in those couple of days together? Did you try and live as a family, or was it just a matter of sitting down and
discussing? No, it wasn't that deep. We didn't have that much time to do all that. But we just...
It wasn't totally method approach then.
No. The main thing really was to kind of free Kai and kind of get him out of his shell and get him comfortable with me and Idris. So it was just playing games, sitting down talking.
Had he ever acted before? Kai.
Yeah, he'd done one thing before this. I think it was theatre. He did some theatre before this, but this was his debut.
Yeah, and Kai as Jerome, I mean, it's a really sensitive portrayal of a child who also is internalising a lot and expressing himself through his love of nature. The bird that he rescues and puts in a box, and it just reminded me also, there's a reference to the birds twittering in Random as well. I mean, is that a recurring motif, the birds tweeting?
You like birds, don't you? They must...
You hadn't even noticed that.
No. I just make stuff up, John. Really? I make stuff up.
Debbie Tucker-Green and Nadine Marshall. The film Second Coming is released in cinemas on Friday the 5th of June, Certificate 15. And Debbie also has a new play called Hang, starring Marianne Jean-Baptiste, that opens at the Royal Court in London on the 11th of June. The new chief executive of Arts Council England, Darren Henley, gave his first speech this afternoon and used it to announce that more lottery money would be spent outside the capital, up from 70% to 75% of overall lottery funds within the next 3 years. But with the revenue funding that the Arts Council hands out to arts organisations shrinking by more than a third over the last 5 years, he also warned against further grant cuts. A short while ago, I spoke to Darren Henley on the line from Hull, where he gave his speech, and which will become the UK City of Culture in 2015, with Chancellor George Osborne expected to announce £30 billion worth of spending cuts in July. Why should the arts be immune?
The arts do an enormous amount to benefit people's lives economically, socially and educationally. And we're making that case to government to say, you know, it's really, really important what we do. Please invest in us.
Mm. But, I mean, we've had that argument for years and years, haven't we? Every pound spent, you get four back. Great for the economy, great for the well-being of the nation. But, and yet the cuts come, I mean, down over a third in 5 years.
And that's why we're making that argument. You know, we're saying we do enormous things for towns and cities like Hull, where I'm sitting right now, right around the country. Really, really powerful things that change people's lives for the better.
Mm. I mean, there have been recently, there have been tax breaks for theatre following those in the film industry. But what makes you think, and I'm quoting here from your speech this afternoon, that the Conservative government understands what the arts do for every citizen and every community and for our nation?
Well, I think the government have helped to make those investments you've talked about in terms of tax breaks, but also investing in our music education hubs, £75 million, an increase year on year. And we're continuing to make that argument to them to say, you know, this really affects people's lives for the better. Mm. And we're a growth industry, not a declining one.
But you must be bracing yourself for further cuts in July.
We will wait and see. We'll keep having the conversation and keep making the case as strongly as we can. That's my job. I'm here to argue as positively as possible for the arts and culture and investment in arts and culture right across England.
But you must be making contingency plans, or certainly your clients would be making contingency plans. A lot of arts organisations really struggling on the budgets that they're having to deal with and thinking, how are we going to cope if we lose another X percent after July? What's the message to them?
And that's why we need to really make the case, working together and say, actually, we can be creative in the solutions we have. The links between the cultural industries and the creative industries are very, very clearly defined, and we're about Britain's growth.
Yes, but we know about that, and you come from the commercial sector, and we hear about it on this programme all the time, that without those subsidised theatre productions, you wouldn't get the big Hollywood blockbusters. You can trace back the talent all the way back to small theatres above pubs. We know those arguments. Do you think the government is really going to listen to that?
I hope they will. I think, you know, the Chancellor is a very cultured man. There are some very cultured people in the government, and I think we need to keep making that case.
Mm. You, as I say, you come from the commercial world. You were running Classic FM for many years. Do arts organisations, those in the public sector, do they need to become more commercially minded, do you think?
I think there's some really entrepreneurial business people running great arts organisations, but I don't think that being an effective business is contrary to actually being incredibly creative. And, you know, it needs to be rooted in pounds, shillings and pence.
Yes, and you've also been talking today about where those pounds, shillings and pence will be spent. You want more money spent outside the capital. More Lottery Arts Council lottery money will be spent out of London, up to 75%. Will you follow suit with the revenue funding then?
Well, with that, the revenue funding for the next cycle will be 2018 to 2021, so we'll have a conversation to prepare working on that over the next few years, depending on what the funding settlements are for us.
So what does that mean? That you are thinking that more money should be spent, more of the revenue funding, the core funding, if you like, to arts organisations, a greater proportion should be spent outside of London?
There's a direction of travel that we've got, but we haven't made any firm decisions at this moment in time. We're looking very much to say that we want to ensure that the government continues to invest in arts and culture right across England.
I mean, a lot of arts organisations within London who are struggling with huge rents would be thinking, well, if 5% extra is spent outside of London, then in terms of the overall Arts Council budget, that would mean there would be something like, well, by my calculations, £22 million a year less spent in London.
Well, look, I'm absolutely committed to maintaining London as a world-class centre for the arts. And, you know, it's really, really important that we have a flourishing arts and cultural community in London. It's really important for us on the international stage. So we're not going to do anything that's going to destabilise London. I want to reassure you of that.
Mm. And your first few days, in effect, Darren, in the Arts Council, so I know you're putting on an optimistic note and a brave face, but are you confident there will still be an Arts Council in 5 years' time?
Yeah, absolutely. Arts Council England, 70 years old next year. England would be a much, much poorer place if we didn't have an Arts Council. And we are working really closely with all the people who are there in the creative world to make sure that we make the case for investing in arts and culture. And I'm very, very confident we will be here for many decades to come.
Darren Henley, the new Chief Executive of Arts Council England. Apparently, I said Hull City of Culture 2015. I meant 2017, obviously. We started the programme with veteran rockers Roger Waters and Nick Mason telling us how they formed Pink Floyd in 1965. Well, we end tonight with another artistic double act of similar vintage. In 1966, Michael Craig Martin and Tom Phillips were young artists determined to shake up the fusty old galleries of the Royal Academy's Summer Exhibition, the annual event which features hundreds of works by established artists alongside amateurs. 5 decades on and the pair are elder statesmen of the RA. Tom Phillips has his own room at this year's Summer Show. The honour was bestowed by guest curator Michael Craig Martin, the former Goldsmiths lecturer whose students included Damien Hirst and Sarah Lucas, and who's hailed as the godfather of Brit art, gave Front Row an exclusive preview as the exhibition was being hung. Michael, when you were invited to guest curate these rooms to be the chief coordinator for this year's summer exhibition at the Royal Academy, did you have a master plan straight away? Did you think, this is what I'm going to do and it's going to be X, Y, Z?
I didn't have a plan, but I did have certain ideas. As soon as I start to think about it, it's different when you're thinking about actually doing it yourself. You suddenly, things click into your head about what I thought were lost opportunities or things I didn't like in previous summer shows. So one of the first things I did was to move a lot of things from their most familiar place. So architecture for many years has been in the gallery directly in front of you as you come into the octagon, as you enter. It's not a terribly large gallery. It has 3 entrances. It always had lots of plinths in it because of architecture.
Ends and up it being wasn't very busy big. In that.
It was very crowded and a bad. So that's been moved to what's called the large Western Room, which is double the size. And I think the architecture has benefited enormously from that. And we've gained possibly the most beautiful painting gallery in the whole set of galleries. That room has beautiful light, beautiful location.
So the first thing that you've done is create space in the Royal Academy show, which is traditionally associated with it's always very busy. The walls are absolutely jam-packed full of paintings. It's always packed full of people in here as well.
What I've tried to do also is I've had the feeling in past years that sometimes the galleries feel too much as you go from one gallery to another, that they're hung in such a similar way that you don't have a sense of difference between one room and another.
But we can also read into the look of these galleries the sort of artist you are, which there's always a sense of space in your paintings, but also colour. And the first thing that strikes us when we walk into the central atrium is that incredibly vibrant turquoise. You've painted every inch of wall space there, turquoise. We move to the left into the next gallery, the one we're standing at the moment, and it really is a very bright, what is this, fuchsia,
magenta pink. It's a kind of deep pink.
Yes, that's going to send shock waves through the old guard here.
I hope so. And then we have sky blue in the gallery on the other side of the centre, which is the other large gallery, which is devoted principally to sculpture. So we've got sculpture on one side, painting on the other. These kind of colours are very much associated with me, but I have a lot of experience of using them. And one of the things that I found was that people assume that very bright colours will detract from works of art, and so often when colour is used in galleries or museums, in order not to do that, people use bland colours, greys and dark greens and beiges and things like that. This kills works of art. But I don't see any work in this room that isn't enhanced by being on the colour. I don't see anything that's damaged. I think actually it brings out the colour in a lot of the pictures. I didn't want to have too much color, so there's only 3 of the galleries. The 3 central galleries have been painted. All the others, all the surrounding galleries are white in a traditional way. It was just to key some color into it, because it also binds the work in a room together. And what I love is being able to look through the great arched entrances from one gallery to another. You can see into the turquoise gallery and beyond that into the blue gallery. This gives a sense of identity to each room.
So this is the approach. First of all, it's creating a bit of space, then flooding the galleries with very bright, vibrant colour. And the next decision you have to make is which artists are going to hang on these walls. We walk in, and the first one I noticed is a big one there, which I saw in your studio a few weeks ago. There's a Michael Craig Martin.
I decided it was best not to be shy in the circumstances. We have fantastic things in this gallery. The centrepiece is really the Richard Long. It's a carborundum print. It's not even a painting. It's
a print. print, is it?
It looks like the... Well, we should just explain. It's a very large rectangular board or canvas, whatever he's created the piece on there, which has got a black field with white drips all the way down. It looks like drips of paint, but then in fact that's a print.
It's called a carborundum print. And it's absolutely stunning in this room.
On the facing wall over there, there's a photograph of a close-up photograph of a red pair of sports shorts, silky shorts, and two pairs of hands rummaging deep inside those shorts. Is that Wolfgang Tillmans?
That's a Wolfgang Tillmans. I think it's obviously a provocative image, but there's nothing about it that's pornographic, or you couldn't possibly say that about it.
No, but some of the old guard of the Royal Academy, once they get over possibly the colour on the walls, they're going to turn around and see that. Oh, my goodness.
It's quite
a conservative institution,
I think it's very important that there be some works within the exhibition which touch on different areas of provocation. There's not a lot, but I mean, you know, we have the Room of Drawings by William Kentridge, who is one of the most important political artists. That's one of the star turns of the exhibition. It's a real treat to have those things here.
And talking of star names, here's one right behind us. This is a Jasper Johns, a brand new work from Jasper, straight from Jasper Johns studio. And just above that, there's a painting, an abstract painting, and this is the work of another of your guest artists here. This is Tom Phillips.
This is Tom Phillips, who's been an RA for many years, and Tom has been working on a work for 50 It's nearly 50 years he's been working at it. He started it in 1966, which was the year he and I met, and it's called The Humament, and it's a doctored Victorian book. And I think it's also another wonderful thing for the Academy to pay a tribute to this long work.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. Tom Phillips is around the corner waiting for us. Yes. Let's go and see his work. And here in his dedicated gallery at the other end of the Royal Academy is Tom Phillips with his epic project, which is now, 48 years old, this project,
49 years old. I started this in 1966, November the 5th, 1966.
You met Michael Craig Martin, according to him.
Just before I met Michael, for the first time.
And what we see on the walls all around us are dozens, possibly hundreds of pages taken from a Victorian novel, which you bought at
a furniture repository in Peckham. And I was walking along with Ron Kitai, R.B. Kitai, who was, of course, a member here. Yeah. And I said, I wanted to get a book and work on it, and the first book I find for threepence, I'll spend the rest of my life doing. He said, really? And I said, yes. And then we looked through the books in this stuff, and the first book I came across that was threepence was a book called A Human Document. And I've lived with that book every day.
And the novel, who wrote it?
Now for 49 years. It's by a man, the sort of Victorian novelist, W.H. Malick, a rather stuffy, conservative or Tory Victorian figure, but a pretty good writer.
So what you did is you started, adapting the pages, drawing on the pages, writing on the pages, and you set yourself that task. You've done it, you did do it every day. And the title itself, The Humament, that comes from the original title of the book, which is a Human Document.
Human Document. If you fold one page over the other, and reading across the top, it goes a Humament. So I thought, they've given me the title, what more do I want? I've got the book, the title, I've got the life task. I happen to be, you know, very well hung, as they say, by Michael Craig Martin, and for which I'm really grateful. And, you know, I'm really most grateful for the other members of the Royal Academy not making any grouse about my having a whole gallery to myself.
It's quite a rare accolade, that, isn't it?
Yeah, usually you have to be dead. But I might still make it to the opening, so...
And the RA Summer Show opens on the 8th of June. Tomorrow, we're at the Hay Festival. Join Samira, 7:15.